But there were no party rules prohibiting the Republican National Committee, the RNC, from making such a move. If it had been adopted, it could have given the Republican Party a jump start on planning a general election matchup with President Biden, who has begun framing his re-election campaign as a 2020 rematch against Donald Trump. There was also precedent for the committee to declare a candidate the presumptive nominee before winning the 1,215 requisite delegates to clinch the nomination. Then RNC chair Rince Priebus did so with Donald Trump in May of 2016. Despite losing both the Iowa and New Hampshire contests to Trump, Nikki Haley has argued that her performance, outlasting all the other Trump rivals, shows the strength of her candidacy. Trump currently has 32 delegates to Nikki Haley's 17. There is one delegate left to be assigned after the New Hampshire contest. During a rally on Wednesday night in her home state of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, noted that her campaign had brought in more than $1 million since her second-place finish in New Hampshire. Trump followed up with a remark that appeared aimed at intimidating her donors. "Anybody that makes a contribution to Bird Brain from this moment forth will be permanently barred from the MAGA camp," Donald Trump wrote, using the nickname he has crafted for Nikki Haley and the abbreviation for his Make America Great Again slogan. "We don't want them, and we will not accept them, because we put America first and always will." Nikki Haley's campaign said on Thursday, 25th of January, that it raised an additional $1.2 million after Trump's unhinged pledge to permanently bar any individual who contributed to Haley's campaign. Donald Trump's threats highlight the stark choice in this election: personal vendettas or real conservative leadership, said Haley's spokesperson Anne-Marie Graham Barnes. "Trump's scheme blew up in his face. The contributions to the Haley campaign are pouring in, proof that people are sick of the drama and are rallying behind Nikki's vision for a strong and proud America." Donald Trump's dismissal of any Haley donors had no effect on T.J. Petrizzo, a former top Capitol Hill staffer and now a top lobbyist who supports Nikki Haley. "That's something out of a Godfather movie. Never betray the family. Come on," he added. "You've got to play this through." CNN, Cable News Network, has also covered the same story. A Republican National Committee draft resolution that would have formally declared Donald Trump the Republican Party's 2024 presumptive nominee was withdrawn on Thursday, 25th of January, amid pushback from the former president. David Bossie, the Republican National Committee man from Maryland, who recently endorsed Trump and introduced the resolution, withdrew it, according to two sources familiar with the matter. The Trump campaign had initially approved going forward with the resolution, and the former president himself was also on board until a backlash began. Donald Trump said on his social media platform on Thursday, 25th of January, that the Republican National Committee should not move forward with the resolution, saying he appreciated the effort but was opposing it for the sake of party unity and wanted to finish the process off at the ballot box. His statement came amid concerns from Trump allies that the resolution could anger Republicans because of the perception that Trump was trying to stack the deck against former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, a source close to the former president declared. While the former president would have still needed to reach the delegate requirements necessary to win the nomination if the resolution had been approved and the RNC had shifted to a general election mode, he would have access to the RNC's data operation, benefit from fundraising with the Republican National Committee, and have the support of all the committee's ground operations. It would also have meant the committee would have been supporting Trump and effectively opposing Nikki Haley, an unprecedented break from the party's past approach to the nominating process. A draft copy of the resolution was obtained independently by CNN. Resolved that the Republican National Committee hereby declares President Trump as our presumptive 2024 nominee for the office of President of the United States, and from this moment forward moves into full general election mode, welcoming supporters of all candidates as valued members of Team Trump, the resolution read. An RNC spokesperson said in a statement that this resolution was still just a resolution and not the stance of the committee. Resolutions such as this one are brought forward by members of the RNC. Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel doesn't offer resolutions, Communications Director Keith Schipper said in a statement. Keith Schipper added, "This will be taken up by the Resolutions Committee and they will decide whether to send this resolution to be voted on by the 168 RNC members at our annual meeting next week." The Nikki Haley campaign brushed off the resolution and said, "Republican Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel should organize a debate ahead of the South Carolina primary at the end of February." Who cares what the RNC says? We'll let millions of Republican voters across the country decide who should be our party's nominee, not a bunch of Washington insiders, a spokeswoman for Nikki Haley, Olivia Perez-Cubas, said in a statement.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahi Rahmani Rahim. I'm Umay Biha Mukhtar, your host on IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher, and she will enlighten us on the concept of hijab as guided by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
What are His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei's views of why the hijab is made compulsory in the Iranian society?
Actually, when we say Iranian society, we mean Islamic society.
Okay.
Because the Iranian now society is not just the old-time Irani Mastani system. It's a revolution that was created based on the Islamic system that Imam Khomeini rose up to want to prepare for the reappearance of Imam Zamana, that this nation should at least be a step forward to show their diligence, that they are going, they are practicing the Islamic rule that Imam Zamana wants to lay in its all perfection.
True.
So it's a starting point, right? So yeah. It's not only the Iranian society. It's Iran wants all based on Islam and its principles. And that also principles that I got from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned in what? Quran and Ahadith. You see, the West, Ayatollah Khamenei says that the West, this unbound relation between men and women are very common. So absence of a modest clothing, you know, or a mediator is normal for them. So he says, I don't mean to say that in Western countries all men and women are corrupt. No. You see, he's talking with justice here, Ayatollah Khamenei. He's just saying that everything is wrong. All of you are like that. No. I wouldn't make such accusations, he said. And this is not true, of course. Surely, there are also chaste good men and women among them, the righteous people with virtues. So usually, you know, when Ayatollah Khamenei speaks about this, it's mostly based on what the people, the government does. Yeah. It's not the people, you see. So he wants to say, that reiterate that there are good people, there are virtuous people. Really people, they want to be good, you know. They want to change in their lives.
And that's why he had written that whole letter for you to the youth of the West. And he had written such beautiful things. Just to show that he also is thinking about them. They're important for him.
Yeah, they're important for them. It's like they're also his children.
Yeah.
You know? However, he says, this sexual freedom dominates Western societies, unfortunately. This is mixing of men and women. And it's a major part of Western culture. You know?
Yeah.
A major part that this is very considered, very like stylish, very, you know, smart and very sophisticated. In Western culture, freedom of sexual desire is permitted. And in some cases, unfortunately, unlimited. Why? Because they have the audacity and the, you know, permission to also build buildings like where there are things going on that are so, you know, filled with vulgar things like discos.
Yeah.
You know, alcoholic drinks.
Casinos.
Yeah.
All things to kind of, you know, take you away from what
yes, akal, right?
Is.
Yeah. To just drive your akal down.
And that's how, like, I think we had mentioned once in one of these episodes that this is how they control the society. This is how, you know, they don't let them go further in terms of their spirituality. Yeah. This all is kind of a blockage, yeah?
Yeah.
So, inshallah. So, let's just take a brief intermission and we'll be back. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we've been discussing about what Ayatollah Khamenei's views of the hijab is. And you told us that, in fact, this was not the Iranian society as such. We are talking about the Islamic society. The Iranian society is now the Islamic society, which, in fact, we should be proud of, you know.
Yeah.
And we've been discussing about how the Western ideologies kind of come and limit this progress, especially in terms of our spirituality.
Yeah. He first discusses about how the Western has no limitations between the men and women and allows freely mixing. So he says that some Western countries are so deeply submerged in this area of this freedom between men and women and this deviance, and they've transformed their lives in such embarrassing ways. If you go and see now, it's been institutionalized, you know, like gay and lesbianism. It's all like LGBT and everything is so institutionalized that they find, you know, and if you go and see even there, people find it still strange. The people who are, you know, like they have good morals, their hearts are pure, even if they're Christians, and they believe in proper marriage of man and woman, but they find it too strange that why is this happening? And somehow you see a distance when you see their children getting involved in such nonsense. Yeah. So there are so embarrassing ways for them also.
And also the irony that is, you know, that is okay for us to include and be inclusive to such kind of groups of people, but it's so hard for them to be inclusive to women with hijab.
Yes.
So It's very unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate. And of course, they later regret it. This is what Ayatollah Khamenei says. This is something that Western thinkers, politicians and policymakers cannot resolve. How they cannot resolve? That means they're seeing that such things are giving rise to corruption, embarrassment, diseases. They feel like, what do they do? The youth want it. Why? It's because of their wrong policies. What are these wrong policies based on? They are based on un-Islamic principles. True. And based on their own cultures and biased views, okay? So they cannot resolve now the policymakers, and it has become a big problem for themselves. The West also exported this culture, behavior, and a harmful habit to all the countries, Ayatollah Khamenei says. This corruption did not exist in other countries first. In Muslim countries, even in non-Muslim Eastern countries, such things like this freedom of mixing gatherings, like sexual freedom, did not exist. It was just imported from the West. If you go see Indians, okay, Indians were very respectful first. Yeah. Although they were Hindus, they were not Islamic, like they did have Islam, but they had that shame. But now if you go and see, that shame has gone away. Importing the Western ideas. So they exported these ideas. Those people, ignorant people, took the ideas with both hands. Why? Puppets.
Yeah, very true. We're just going to go on a short break and we'll be back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we were discussing Ayatollah Khamenei's views of the hijab and why it's made compulsory on the Iranian society. And we were discussing about how the Western ideologies are kind of so corrupt, and we are kind of looking at them as the ideal to follow. But they have brought in homosexuality and, you know, this free mixing, while in the past we had so much piety, purity, and, you know, they were shameful. They didn't like showing off their bodies. But now, because everyone's trying to adopt the Western culture that seems the most appropriate, we all want to be like them for some reason, which is unfortunate.
He was also saying about how these things did not exist and they were imported, you know, from the West. So they did not exist. There were a lot of, you know, like modesty in their natures, like some nations, there was a lot of modesty in them. But now, what with this influence, you know, of the West, they even got this in their culture. So now Ayatollah Khamenei says, who stood up? See, he's proud of the former, Islamic leader also. Who stood up? The Islamic revolution and revolutionary leader, Imam Khomeini, resisted this corruption and announced from its beginning, that's very important, that he did not accept this unbound relations between men and women. It believes in the necessity of a modest appearance and Islamic-based relations between men and women. The Islamic Republic insisted on this way of life. Some people think that this is an unimportant, trivial issue. True. But they are at best wrong. This is an important, extremely important, that too, a matter. Then he says, I should tell you here that one of the main reasons for Western animosity towards the Islamic revolution has to do with this matter, that is the hijab. Unlimited sexual behavior. We don't allow it, they allow it.
Yeah.
They feel, you know, what is wrong with it?
Yeah.
Why are these people resisting? Then he says, they are extremely defensive over this issue. If the Islamic Republic had been less strict solely on this matter of hijab, probably, you know, allowing it or not allowing it or being loose the way they are, and had allowed the Western culture of unbound immorality regarding unhealthy relations of men and women to appear in our society, much opposition from political and non-political spheres in the West would have diminished.
Yeah,
they would have said, okay, now at least they've adopted this idea, leave them alone, you know?
Yeah.
But they are like, what's wrong? And why are these people progressing, yet they are doing this? They just like, I feel they are very jealous. They are very jealous.
Yeah.
Or they have been totally obliterated it.
True. I feel like this is kind of making someone realize that you don't need all of this to survive. I remember when we used to see, movies, or when we used to see some documentaries, and they talk about these people who have been, you know, wasting their time by and going to get drunk, and, you know, after a hard day's work, they go straight to the pub or something. Or they go and watch immoral things. Right now, the Pornhub is like, you feel so
commercialized.
And it's one of the biggest industries right now. So it's very scary. And they feel like, how is it possible that this country is going on without all these distractions? We don't need to, you know, to detoxify ourselves and go home and go get a drink. But they need that to survive. Mm. So it's very interesting how we work so differently and we are yet thriving successful, you know.
Yes.
So it's very beautiful, alhamdulillah.
So then he says that, you see, in our country, once the removal of headscarves became obligatory, but no one in the world objected the compulsory removal of hijab. Okay?
Yeah.
In our neighboring country, Turkey, removal of hijab became compulsory. And even until recently, some Turkish governments continued this obligation, as we witnessed examples during the recent years. But nobody on the planet ever objected this move.
Yeah.
So they made it compulsory to remove. We made it compulsory to wear. Again, he says.
Yeah.
More striking than that is what happens in some European countries, which consider themselves as advanced, so-called advanced. Though human rights and public opinion are presented as important in their propagations and claims, in France, human rights are important, he says. But in France, girls are not allowed to go to human rights here, you see? In France, girls are not allowed to go to school whilst wearing headscarves. So why? Where's the freedom there, yeah?
True. Yeah.
In this case, compulsion, that is force, is permissible for them. And they see nothing wrong with it. However, they object the fact that the Islamic Republic has made a modest dress compulsory. So what is the difference there? Yeah? If there's a problem with forcing women to appear in society with a specific type of clothing, it's worse than compulsory hijab, because wearing hijab is closer to well-being. At least these two obligations must be viewed with equal judgment, he says. But the West does not present this perspective. He says that, no, we have forced, it's okay, but you should have forced. You see?
Yeah.
So at least they should view it as with justice, yeah? If True. They think that, okay, freedom of rights, they make the policies, so...
Yeah, and I think people have this kind of idea in their mind that, you know, Iran is so oppressive and, oh my God, the people of Iran, what are they going through? And those people haven't really even come into Iran to see the situation. They're just seeing based on what the social media is kind of presenting to them. So we were just hearing a lecture a while ago by the speaker who is a German, and he lived in the US and he's come here as a professor, he's a Shia, and he said that his parents were very against him becoming Shia, especially and going to Iran. But he was trying to explain them, but they weren't like understanding, and then they accepted it. But he said the time his mother really accepted it was when she came to Iran and said, "Oh, I didn't know that the people of Iran were actually living normal lives. We thought they were all oppressed. We thought you are getting oppressed as well. You're being brainwashed." She said that, "Now I understand that they're living like normal people. They're living normal lives.
And the women too, when they hijab, they're living completely normal lives
yeah.
and enjoying, right?
Yeah, it's very beautiful, alhamdulillah. So thank you so much for, you know, your valuable time and your beautiful points. And we hope to see you, inshallah, in the next episode.
Inshallah.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
For thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us reflect on an aphorism worth pondering upon from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He who gallops with loose rein collides with death.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله
Why Yemen?
Part 3
Maritime trade and control give superiority in the world. No matter how big a trade on the land is, it won't find a better route for business than the sea. These are the words of Alfred Thayer Mahan, the author of The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, which deals with the importance of sea routes in maritime trade and control over them. About 200 million years ago, all of the lands on the Earth were connected in a supercontinent named Pangaea, but gradually the unified continent started to be divided into different chunks. After tens of millions of years, the map of the Earth looks like what we see today with several separate continents. Now, the link between the continents on Earth has been established in two ways, through land between Asia, Africa, and Europe, and through the oceans in the Americas, Australia, and Antarctica. Meanwhile, some waterways, natural straits, and artificial canals that were constructed later had a strategic role in shaping the famous maritime corridors today for shipping to access the shortest and most cost-effective routes. Choke points are the links that connect the sea and land. Today, having control over the strategic points gives astonishing powers to countries. Some of the most important waterways in the world are the Malacca, Hormuz, Gibraltar, and Bab el-Mandab Straits, as well as man-made canals like the Suez and Panama. The Panama Canal was constructed in 1914, so ships in the Atlantic Ocean won't have to turn all the way around South America. The Strait of Gibraltar connects the Mediterranean to the Atlantic Ocean between Spain and Morocco. It's been officially under British control since 1713. The Cape of Good Hope in the southern tip of Africa serves as a link between the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. This is part of the route for the ships that sail from the South Asia to the eastern coast of America. The Bosphorus Strait in Turkey connects the Black Sea to the Sea of Marmara and then the Mediterranean. Besides, the strait facilitates countries like Russia and Ukraine with access to the Mediterranean and high seas. We can argue the Hormuz Strait that joins the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman is now considered the most vital waterway in the world for transit of energy. The Suez Canal in Egypt was constructed in 1869 by France and Britain. Besides its strategic importance, it is used to establish a link between Europe to West Asia and led to flourishing business into other natural straits in the world, namely Bab el-Mandab and Malacca. The Malacca Strait is located in Southeast Asia between the Indonesian island of Sumatra and the Malay Peninsula. Many experts believe it's the most important maritime choke point in the world. According to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, about 60% of maritime trade passes through Asia. The South China Sea alone carries one-third of the global shipping. The route depends on the Malacca Strait, which connects the South China Sea and the Pacific Ocean to the Indian Ocean. The route is the artery of major economic powers in Asia, like Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and especially China, the second largest economy in the world. Every year, over 100,000 ships in the South China Sea sail towards the Malacca Strait. The Bab el-Mandab Strait, a strait between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, and joins Asia to the Horn of Africa. In 2014, the Ansarullah movement turned into the main power in Sana'a in northern Yemen. Mansour Hadi stepped down after he saw the political situation in the country and fled to Riyadh.
The Yemen war coincided with the ascendance of a new king, King Salman, who more broadly saw Saudi Arabia as needing to take a greater position on the regional stage. And this is very clear in the Horn of Africa, Saudi Arabia describing it as sort of a missed opportunity to be a leader.
Gradually, the Ansarullah asserted its control over Yemen's army and other parts of the country. 6 months after the revolution in September of 2014, the Yemeni forces reached the port of Aden, the last bastion supported by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015, and became the dominant force in the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait. Saudis did not have the power to wrest back control over Yemen by the Ansarullah, so they asked Arab rulers in the Persian Gulf and some other countries like Egypt, Sudan, and Jordan for help. A large coalition comprised of 9 Arab countries was preparing for an invasion on Yemen. The coalition was led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Abu Dhabi had been laying in wait for years to practice its influence in the region. The UAE used its military experience in the Horn of Africa and assumed command role in the southern part of Yemen and the Bab al-Mandab region. The Emirates knew full well that they're given a golden opportunity that won't repeat. It had to gain control over southern Yemen and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, even at the cost of spending millions of dollars or losing hundreds of military forces.
The United States is a partner in this war. It is a partner every day, as you laid out, refueling aircraft, providing additional ordnance, providing intelligence, providing logistics. If the United States of America and the United Kingdom tonight told King Salman this war has to end, it would end tomorrow, because the Royal Saudi Air Force cannot operate without American and British support. We've not done that. At the same time, the president has yet to explain to the American people why we are engaged in a war in Yemen against the Houthi, Saidi, Shia people.
By using military bases in Africa and by using the Assab Air Base in Eritrea as the headquarters, the UAE Air Force launched a massive airstrike against Yemeni forces and, as a first step, managed to take control of the Aden port in southern Yemen by supporting the militants of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, the STC.
One of the things that the UAE is doing at this particular base is actually building a new naval facility so that over time they won't have to use the port of the city Assab itself, but they'll have their own docks right at their military base. And since September 2015, dredging vessels have been creating a new channel, shaping the coastline to form that port, basically.
The southern ports of Yemen were the scenes of heavy clashes between 2015 and 2018. Considering the military superiority of the Saudi-led coalition and complete support by the U.S., gradually the ports near Bab al-Mandab and the Red Sea, like Al-Khawkha, Mocha, and Dubab, got out of the Ansarullah's control.
It may be Saudi planes that are dropping the bomb, but they are U.S. bombs. It is U.S. assistance that provides the targeting.
The UAE and forces under its command in southern Yemen were dreaming about gaining control over the western coast of Yemen and in early 2018 launched a massive operation to capture Al-Hudaydah port on the Red Sea coast, but Yemen's army put up a stiff resistance at the gates of the city and inflicted a heavy loss on the coalition forces. The coalition and other forces had to retreat. After a while, the Sana'a-based government and the former government signed the Stockholm Peace Agreement.
A huge disruption should at any point the Bab al-Mandab, by virtue of the Houthis, who are the rebels in Yemen, we'll discuss them in a minute, should they decide somehow to control the flow of maritime traffic through here, huge disruption to the global economy.
The defeat in the Hudaydah operation had a serious impact on the future strategy of Abu Dhabi in the Yemen war. Gradually, the UAE decided to pull out its forces and complete its geopolitical and economic plans between the Bab al-Mandab Strait and the Arab Sea.
I think the Gulf states and the UAE understand very well that that's their future. And so military basing comes later, and with the kind of first training with the piracy and now larger training efforts, and of course then 2015 Yemen. But these things have been building in gears that have been turning and widening in scope.
But the defeat was not the only reason that the UAE evaded the military conflict with the Ansarullah. It was from that period that, by changing the balance of power, And after the Yemeni people got access to long-range strategic weapons, the Emirati leaders felt the main threat is posed against their own territory by the long-range cruise missiles and suicide drones of Yemen's army.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. Welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. From today on, we're going to start the 10 days of Fajr. That means the 10 days between February 1st or Bahman 12th and February 11th. On 1977 are called Fajr Decade, which Imam Khomeini entered to Iran after 15 years of exile, and the greatest welcome in history took place from him in Tehran, and eventually the Pahlavi regime was extinct after more than 50 years of oppression and tyranny on February 23rd. So congratulations, and today is Thursday, 20th of Rajab, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 12th of Bahman, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 1st of February, 2024 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We'll listen chapter Al-Baqarah, verse 270.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وما أنفقتم من نفقة أو نذرتم من نذر فإن الله يعلمه وما للظالمين من أنصار.
And whatever you spend of expenditures or make of vows, indeed Allah knows of it. And for the wrongdoers, there are no helpers.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The objective meaning of unjust here is those who spend their wealth in the way of disobedience of Allah and committing sins. They do not give the alms of their property, or they vow to do that which is sin. For such people, there will be no friend who can save them from the divine judgment or prevent his punishment.
In the month of Bahman, the month of Islamic Revolution, be with today's special.
Islamic Revolution as a Republic. We're going to discuss about that. The popularity of the Islamic Revolution is a significant characteristic manifested in its republican aspect. The popularity of the Islamic Revolution is different from that of other revolutions. Firstly, popularity is with the essence of Islam. Islam keeps the people in the scene in a real and true manner. The long-standing years of people's true presence in the revolutionary scenes and their participation in the elections of all officials, as well as their contribution to the preservation of the achievements of the Islamic Revolution, are all manifestations of truthful popularity of the Islamic system. Congratulations on the 10th day of Fajr, Fajr decade, which Imam Khomeini entered to Iran after the 15 years of exile in 1977.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. In this visual, we shall be talking about the Islamic Revolution and its difference with other revolutions. The revolution that happened in Iran, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and its difference with other revolutions, and what made it that much different, and what characteristics made it that different from other revolutions. The unique characteristic of the Iranian Revolution in comparison to other major revolutions around the world, such as China and Russia, is its founding based on the divine teachings of Islam. This all-encompassing and universal religion, its founding based on the divine teachings of Islam, that is an all-encompassing and universal religion. This extraordinary phenomenon was achieved with the goal of reviving Islamic values and giving religion sovereignty, free from any tendencies or influences from human schools of thought. The religious nature, leadership power, key role of the clergy, and mass participation are the most important distinguishing aspects of the Islamic Revolution compared to other revolutions.
IRIB English Radio in the month of Bahman presents
today's special. Islamic Revolution quotes Dr. Kalim Siddiqui, director of the Muslim Institute London, offers this assessment. Since the revolution in Iran, I have been moving around some of the Sunni countries, some of the most reactionary, if I might put it that way. I can assure you that the people in those countries have been absolutely galvanized and their imaginations have been captured. Some of them take the precaution of locking their doors before they talk about it. If national boundaries were taken away, probably Ayatollah Khomeini would be elected by acclamation by the Ummah as a whole as the leader of Muslim world today. Islamic Revolution achievements of four decades. An important principle in the Islamic Republic is Velayat Faqih, which pertains to the leadership of the system. This leader enjoys certain criteria and specifications. The Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution has mentioned the characteristics of Vali Faqih, means supreme jurisprudent. There are piety, justice, courage, management, prudence, awareness of domestic and foreign political issues, and mastery of Islamic sciences. Wali Faqih, as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, is appointed by the Assembly of Experts, who are in turn elected by the people's votes. The 45 years' experience of the Islamic Republic clearly shows that the leader plays the prime role in preservation of the system, the rights of the people, and resolving the internal and external problems.
In today's episode, we're going to go through some of the important events that took place before the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. It's history recap time. Number one, the extraterritoriality law. Now, what is that, you may ask? Well, basically, it's an extraterritorial violation of human rights. The Pahlavi regime approved a law in the parliament which granted immunity to American personnel so they could not be prosecuted by Iranian courts, the judiciary, and security organizations. This is called extraterritoriality. When foreigners are allowed to enter a country and do whatever they like, and the courts and police forces of that country are unable to do anything to stop foreigners meddling in its affairs. It shows that the country has an extreme form of weakness and dependence. And unfortunately, we still got a lot of countries living under this law, till this day. Number two, the Qiyam of the People of Qom. In January 1978, the people of Qom rose up in a public demonstration against the Pahlavi regime and its policies. Why? Well, because the Pahlavi regime published an article in a newspaper called Itla'at, one of the largest publications in circulation in Iran. The article insulted Ayatollah Khomeini while he was in exile. I mean, you can't just insult an honorable leader and get away with it. So then the Shah's security forces cracked down on the peaceful protesters and forcibly suppressed the Iranian people who supported Imam Khomeini. This caused a huge wave of protests in major cities like Tabriz, Shiraz, Tehran, and Mashhad. And this incident echoed throughout Iran and quickly became a standing point for the Islamic Revolution. Number three, the Den of Espionage. So, a group of university students following the Islamic Revolution took over the American embassy in Tehran and named it the Den of Espionage. Why did they name it so? Well, because the personnel in the American embassy had a huge spy network that was spying on Iranians and even in the broader Western Asian region. Now, the American media constantly insists that the activities of the US embassy in Iran were normal. Yeah, right. Countless documents were discovered and publicly disclosed that showed that this was no simple embassy. They described the Iranian uni students as wild, irrational, and in violation of international laws. Really? Who was violating international laws? Well, the first thing to consider is to respect the laws of any host country. So even though an embassy has immunity, it doesn't mean that it can violate the laws of the host country. You can't just violate laws and get away with it. Second point is the embassies should not interfere in a country's internal affairs. The American personnel at the US embassy had been violating Iran's laws and interfering in the country's internal affairs, and there's documentation to prove it. Number four, the Air Force Pledge Allegiance. On the 8th of February 1979, the Air Force met Imam Khomeini and pledged allegiance to him. Now, the Air Force is one of the strongest arms in any country's military. So it became one of the strongest supports for the new emerging revolution. The Air Force was one of the closest forces to the power center of the Pahlavi regime. So they were struck a blow from where they never expected. Amazing. Number 5. On January 16, Shah and his family fled Iran for Egypt, ostensibly for vacation. As he departed, he kinda gave Iran over to the Prime Minister Bakhtiar, saying, "I give Iran into your care, yours and God's." Bakhtiar then announced a countrywide curfew and martial law. And that didn't go down pretty well. People came out united against the Shah regime, demanding for an Islamic society, and rose up in a national revolution against westernizing their country. And that leads us into the present with a beautiful Islamic nation stronger than ever before, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
So from today on, we start the Fajr decade. 10 days of celebration for returning Imam Khomeini to Iran after his exile in 1977. Thank you very much for listening to us and have a nice time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.